So today I've got the lovely Dr. Zamina here with me to talk all about progesterone and PCOS. Now, we did a podcast about this a few months ago now. It's part one, and we had so many follow-up questions. And this is a tool that both Zamina and I use with many of our patients. While I'm not a doctor, so I can't prescribe progesterone, I refer a lot of my patients to either their doctor or another doctor to be prescribed progesterone if I think it's going to be helpful for them, because it's such a useful tool for so many people. And so today we're just doing a follow-up on that to answer many of the questions about the ins and outs of progesterone, how it works, and where it can be useful. So for those of you that don't know, Dr. Zamina is a naturopathic doctor. She's based in Ontario, Canada. She can only take patients from Ontario, Canada. So if you do want to book with her, please only do so if you're from Ontario. We'll put all the links to her Instagram, social media channels, and also her website in the accompanying show notes for today. But she is an incredible naturopathic doctor. We constantly are sharing research articles between us around different things in PCOS. She also has PCOS herself, so she knows what it's like. She understands the symptoms, and she, like me, uses a variety of tools to help women get back their hormonal balance. So whether that's nutrition, whether that's supplements, naturopathic treatments like herbs, or natural hormones like progesterone that we're talking about today. And often that's alongside conventional medicine, depending on what you as the patient like. So I hope you get a huge amount of value out of today's podcast all about progesterone, volume two. Zamina, thank you so much for coming back and joining me on the podcast. The last podcast that we did all about cyclical progesterone therapy was so informative, and we've had so many people coming back to us, sliding into our DMs, saying how informative that was. So thank you so much for coming back and doing a follow-up.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk about this. You know, yes. I love a good progesterone talk.
I know, so do I. And it's just such a good thing, because again, I think it's something that a lot of people are not getting from their practitioner, that this is an option for them. So it's so good for them to be able to take this information back to their practitioner and ask about it, and potentially help, you know, educate their practitioner about what a great treatment this is for people with PCOS especially.
Yeah,
so before we get into it, I thought what we'd do is just do a quick recap of actually what progesterone is. And I'd also recommend, if you haven't listened to part one of this podcast, you click on the link in the show notes and go back and listen to that, because this is going to be the more extra for experts questions, and you might get a little bit lost if you haven't understood the first part of it. So go back, stop this podcast now, go back, listen to that first one, and then come back and listen to this. And we'll just do a quick, for those that have listened to it, it might have been a few weeks ago, maybe a few months ago, we'll just do a quick recap, and then we can get into the more in-depth questions that people have sent through. And these questions have come from you guys. So we put a question box up on our Instagram asking you, and you did the same with yours as well, Zamina as well. So we've got a bunch of questions here that you guys have asked, and we're going to go through as many as possible of those. So before that, let's just go back and chat a little bit about progesterone. So do you want to start us off, Zamina, just talking about how progesterone is created in our bodies, in cycling female bodies?
Yeah, okay. So first things first, I think the number one thing everybody really needs to know is we only make progesterone after we ovulate. That's like basically the blanket statement. So I'm going to go back now and kind of explain what happens. So in the first part of our cycle, we build estrogen, and estrogen allows for that follicle to grow to size. Usually we want it to be around 2 millimeters or 2 centimeters.
Follicle, we mean baby egg, right? That's really what
basically, yeah, just the follicle that kind of like houses the egg that's about to ovulate at some point in the cycle. So yeah, the follicle is basically houses the egg. It gets created by estrogen. And what happens is when it gets to size, estrogen peaks at this point. And once estrogen peaks, that follicle can now ovulate. So what's going to happen is LH is a luteinizing hormone. It's going to cause luteinization. And basically what that means is that that follicle is going to open up and the egg is going to kind of come out of that follicle, make its way down the fallopian tube. And that's where it can rest for about 24 hours for possible conception. So what happens to that follicle that releases the egg? That follicle actually becomes something called a corpus luteum. And that corpus luteum is actually what creates progesterone in the second half of the cycle. And so we really only make progesterone, like we make a little bit in the first part, but really the prime progesterone comes in that second half of that cycle where that corpus luteum is made. And so that's like the main thing you want to know about progesterone. It's not, you know, yeah, I think that's pretty much it. Yeah. Like it comes from that corpus luteum.
Yeah, it's a great explanation. It's just that one thing to remember is that, so this is why when you're measuring progesterone, often if a practitioner doesn't really know your cycle or what they're doing, they might say get your progesterone measured on day 21. But that is entirely dependent on when you ovulate, right? And people with PCOS often have extended cycles. So what's happening in an extended cycle, so maybe your cycle is 45 days or 50 days, is that your body has tried to ovulate, tried to create that egg multiple times, but it kind of, that follicle never reaches size, as you said.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
So it sort of like discards that egg, discards that follicle, and then, you know, gets the next big egg off the production line and starts to develop that one. So this is why, you know, we can have long cycles in PCOS, and also why when you're measuring progesterone, it's really important to know when you're ovulating. And if you don't know when that is, it's probably safer to go with, like, let's say 11 to 14 days before you're expecting your period. So if your periods are quite regular around about, say, the 45 days, then probably a safer bet is to go with 10 to 14 days prior to that.
Yeah.
So, but you don't need to measure your progesterone for this chat. That's not part of it.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's really a good recap. So there is a question that we had, which is, so why then is progesterone often low in that what's called so when you do ovulate, the period between that time and your actual period bleed, the time in there is called your luteal phase. So why is progesterone often low in the luteal phase for people with PCOS?
Yeah. So we talked about, you know, in the luteal phase, that's when we're making the progesterone from that corpus luteum. And if, for example, we don't build a good quality follicle in that first half of the cycle, and when I say good quality follicle, we need like a good balance between estrogen and testosterone to like really make that really nice looking follicle that's going to house that egg. Then what can happen is once that follicle goes to ovulate, causing, you know, it to open up, it might not create the best corpus luteum. So when we don't make the best corpus luteum, our progesterone can be lower. And so that's why in women with PCOS, we might not be making a good amount of progesterone, because what happens is in the first part of the cycle, we're making so much testosterone that it impacts our ability to make a good amount of estrogen. So, and like you said, like there's going to be times where like a follicle is going to be trying to be built, trying to get that egg to ovulate at some point, but then all of a sudden testosterone comes in and blocks that process. Too much testosterone is going to prevent that follicle from getting to size to ovulate. So if that testosterone is there, then it can actually end up causing low progesterone in the second half of the cycle. But I want you to remember this, is that the luteal phase, so that second part of the cycle, ovulation to period, is often very much dependent on what happens in the first half of the cycle. Mm-hmm. So we always have to look at the first half of the cycle to like see what's actually happening with that estrogen and testosterone.
Yeah. And so a way that someone could know without even having to get their progesterone tested, know that they have this, low progesterone in the luteal phase, could be the number of days between when they ovulate and when they get their period, right?
That's right. Yeah. So if it's like a shorter luteal phase, definitely it's a sign. that progesterone can be lower.
And I say shorter luteal phase is less than 11 days. Is that your understanding as well?
Good. Yeah.
Say that 11 days is good. So if you're measuring how you would know if you're ovulating, probably the most accurate way in PCOS, for those that are not using progesterone, is basal body temperature. And one of the ways that you can do from home anyway. And so if you want to know more about that, chapter 10 in my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS, covers how to know when you're ovulating, and then also how to know if you've got this short luteal phase. So that's a really good way of knowing whether, you know, potentially that could be a factor for why you're not getting pregnant, or not just not getting pregnant, but also maybe you're getting really bad PMS symptoms. You know, PMS, PMDD, if you've got a short luteal phase, you're not producing good amounts of progesterone, or relatively, you know, maybe more estrogen than what you are progesterone, then that can lead to a lot of those PMS symptoms like irritability, mood swings, insomnia, depression, tender breasts, things like that.
Yeah.
So this is another question that we had, and I think we've kind of answered this, but it's good to go over again. So the question was, do you ovulate later if you have low progesterone? And so I think now that we understand the fundamentals of how we produce progesterone, that we have to ovulate first to then produce the progesterone, then that kind of answers that question, that it's actually more, the question was, do you ovulate later if you have low progesterone? So the answer is, well, actually the progesterone is caused by the ovulation. So it's more the other way around, right?
Exactly. It's like what comes before that that's causing the low progesterone. So we talked about like high testosterone and low estrogen in that first half of the cycle. So that's when ovulation can happen later. So that when we ovulate later, then we're going to potentially have lower progesterone in the second half of the cycle.
Yeah. Okay. So then now what's the difference between, so when we're talking about progesterone, often we hear about progesterone in the context of the pill or maybe, you know, Provera, and people say, well, you're taking progesterone because you're taking Provera, but those aren't actually progesterone, right? They are synthetic progestins. So what's the difference between a progestin that we take, say, in the combined pill or in a medication like Provera, and the progesterone that our body produces?
Yeah, so biggest difference is progestins are synthetic form of progesterone, meaning that it's man-made in the lab. And the bioidentical progesterone that's micronized. So when we say micronized, it's just in a form that's as small as we can get it. So we can actually get it through the digestive system if we're taking it orally. And then bioidentical, meaning it looks exactly like really, really, really close to the progesterone we produce in our body. So the actual chemical structure of the progesterone that we use in bioidentical progesterone is very similar to what we're seeing in our body. So then therefore it can actually work on the progesterone receptors, which is really interesting. Yeah.
And I think probably the best way to describe it is that a progestin is similar to progesterone. So it can block the progesterone receptors in our brain, but it's kind of like a mirror image of progesterone. So it's like if you take your left hand and you layer your right hand over the top of it, those are the same. Like if you put your left and right hand together, they will look identical, but actually when you lay them over the top, you'll see that the thumb is on the other side. Right? And so they're almost identical, but just slightly different. And therefore they have slightly different things in our body. Like the progestin you take in the combined pill, that helps to block ovulation, right? Whereas the progesterone that our body makes is a result of ovulation, and it does, you know, lots of different things in the body. So that's why they have different, you know, responses. And so when we're talking about micronized progesterone, the progesterone that we can take orally or vaginal pessaries, that is where they've made it. So it actually is as close to the progesterone that our body produces, as opposed to the mirror image, which is more the progestin.
That's right. Yeah. So it actually comes from wild yam, and wild yam is a botanical, and what they're extracting from that is something called diosgenine. and diastinine is this compound that looks very similar to our natural progesterone. So that's what they're using in that progesterone suppository or oral pill.
Yeah. So if you've listened to the last episode that we did, we talked about using that kind of micronized progesterone to help with period regulation. So whether that be someone that hasn't had, that's completely amenorrheic. Amenorrhea means that you haven't had a period for a long time. It might be a year or more, or someone that's getting really long cycles in PCOS. So, you know, 40, 50, 60 days long, or someone with a short luteal phase, and that we can actually use this micronized progesterone to help improve the, you know, all of those different pictures. Mm-hmm. So, So now that people understand how we can, you know, just when we talk about using that, what we talked about in that last podcast was using progesterone to mimic what your body would be producing. So mimic that after you've ovulated, your body should be producing progesterone for about 14 days, and then you get your period. And then while you get your period, your body's producing estrogen to create that really good follicle, so that when you do ovulate, you then produce good amounts of progesterone. And then we kind of, what I think about, like, we're just sort of topping up your body's natural levels by mm-hmm. using that cyclical progesterone. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of, we're not introducing anything new. We're just kind of topping up your levels.
Yeah. And also, like, what happens is when we put the progesterone in the second half of the cycle, it does help to bring testosterone down, because what's happening is it's reducing that GnRH pulsing from the brain. So that allows us to, you know, helps us to ovulate on the next cycle. Mm-hmm. The other thing to note that we didn't actually mention is you need just like a little bit. We do make like a little bit of progesterone right around ovulation. So even just like when we do the cyclical progesterone, you know, your body would be at that point of, like, you know, creating that follicle, using that progesterone around cycle day 18 or cycle day 14, depending on your case. It does kind of help kickstart that ovulation too, because it does bring testosterone down.
Mm, yeah, nice. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably a good one that leads into the next question, is that we just want to know the difference between what micronized progesterone does and what something like Provera does, right? Because Provera is probably one that people are really familiar with. Many people have been prescribed Provera, especially if they haven't had a period for more than 6 months. It's often prescribed to give you a withdrawal bleed, basically shed that uterine lining so that your risk of endometrial cancer is lessened and you don't get a really thick lining. So what's the difference between what Provera does and what micronized progesterone does?
So I would say the biggest difference is Depo-Provera isn't necessarily working on bringing testosterone down versus micronized bioidentical progesterone, because it's like kind of working on our own progesterone receptors. It has that ability to bring the testosterone down to help us to ovulate by ourselves. So I think that's honestly the biggest difference.
Mm. And so Provera is the synthetic progesterone that we were talking about before.
That's right. Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the micronized progesterone is the progesterone. So, you know, different things. Quickly, just the micronized progesterone, what are the common brand names? Because I think people, we're talking about it as micronized progesterone, but people might be more familiar with brand names. So
yeah. There's so many brand names all around the world.
I know in New Zealand, uterogestin is the most common.
Okay, yeah, we have Crinone here in Canada, Endometrion.
Prometrium.
Yep, yeah. Thanks. Yep. Those are like the big ones, I would say. Mm. And then, you know, getting it compounded in a compounded pharmacy.
Yeah, that's the other way is that it can be made. So you can either have the brand name or it can be compounded. So compounding pharmacy, they are like basically a doctor will send them and say to them, hey, I want 300 milligrams of progesterone or something, and they'll then make it to the instructions. It's kind of like a bespoke pharmacy, I guess, that they can make things, you know, to more like to your requirements, as opposed to the brand, which might, the pill might come in 200 milligram and you can't get a 300 milligram or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's right. They actually use like a powdered extract from Wild Yam, and they put it into a base, and that's how they make the suppositories.
So you could get it prescribed from your practitioner, either the brand name or from a compounding pharmacy. But if they're prescribing Provera, then that's not the same thing. That's not what we're talking about here.
That's right.
So we do, when I've talked to Dr. Julian Pryor at CEMCOR, the Centre of Ovulation and Menstrual Research, she's been pretty clear with me that micronized progesterone does not cause a withdrawal bleed. Pretty much if someone's getting a period because they've used micronized progesterone, then that definitely is due to ovulation. Can you shed any more light as to how we know this?
Yeah, because basically when we make that corpus luteum, it helps us to build our own progesterone. And also helps us in the second half of the cycle in the luteal phase to build our lining. So if we're making that corpus luteum, and it will definitely going to make a good enough lining to have a bleed. Mm. When we are not ovulating, we're not going to make that corpus luteum really nice. So we're not going to make that lining, and we're not going to have like a full flow period. If you're spotting, for example, and you're using progesterone, sometimes what we see is at the beginning, because there's so much testosterone, it kind of like still prevents us from getting a bleed, even though we're on progesterone. It just takes a little bit of time to like get that testosterone down so that we can get that estrogen going to build that follicle, to ovulate, to build that lining so that we have that corpus luteum.
Mm.
If you're getting this like nice full flow period, you're definitely ovulating. But if you're getting like spotty here or there just on wiping, then it's very likely you might not be.
Yeah, cool. So pretty much if you've been using micronized progesterone, and say, you know, we've talked about it in the last podcast, that a really common way to use micronized progesterone is for 14 days. Maybe you have 14 days and then you have 14 days off, or as you said before, another example could be starting it on cycle day 18. But if you're using it for 14 days and then you stop taking it, and then a couple of days later, you get a period where you're having to use a pad or a tampon. So that means you're getting some flow, and that's lasting for at least sort of 2 days, then you can be confident that you did ovulate during that cycle, and that's what caused the bleed, as opposed to this being a withdrawal bleed like you would get from Provera.
That's right.
And I think the other way to think about it is that if you remember, we talked about before how when you're taking the micronized progesterone, it's just really kind of topping your own body levels up. It can't really cause a withdrawal bleed, right? Like Provera can, because the way that Provera works is blocking those receptors in your brain. And then we take it for about 14 days, and then we stop taking it. And then your body gets the message that, oh, we're not taking that anymore, and then shed the lining. Progesterone, right. Just taking micronized progesterone is just topping your levels up. It can't block those receptors. There's nothing happening there. So it cannot cause a withdrawal bleed. So it has to be the result of ovulation.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think that's a really cool thing for people to realize, is that when they do see a period as a result of taking micronized progesterone, that is their body ovulating, which is
exactly, yeah, it's
amazing.
Working. It's doing its thing. Yeah.
So if someone, the Centre of Ovulation and Menstrual Research, mm-hmm. will, again, I've linked to their website in the show notes, and Dr. Julian Pryor has created some really great guidelines for practitioners about how to use this, if you want to pass this on to your practitioner, how to use it cyclically to help people with PCOS. And she goes through there, you know, a lot of different scenarios. So for example, what happens if you take it for 14 days and then you don't get a period, right? Mm-hmm. And so for me, the most common reason I see is probably the dosing's incorrect. Is that one of the reasons you see?
It's possible. Yeah, it could be the dosing is correct. But again, it could also be the patient's testosterone is just off the charts. Yeah, way
and
too
high.
And the
estrogen's not high enough.
Exactly. Estrogen's not high enough to like actually build that lining right after ovulation too, or just to get things going for them to ovulate. Mm. So so that's why usually with many rounds of exposure to progesterone, we will then kind of see the testosterone coming down for the patient to ovulate.
Cool.
I should mention too, if somebody's taken birth control for a really long time as well.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I know when I talked to you last, I know that in clinic you often use, depending on the scenario, but you will often, if this happens for many cycles, you might then test their progesterone and estrogen about 7 days after they started taking the micronized progesterone. And if the estrogen is low, you might combine the micronized progesterone with some estrogen stimulating herbs.
Sometimes, basically, like if estrogen is still low, we'll still keep the progesterone in. Mm-hmm. And then we'll still look at, they'll still need the progesterone for like some more cycles, and then we reevaluate. Yeah. If the patient's making good amount of estrogen in the second half of the cycle and they're getting regular periods with the progesterone, then yeah, we can experiment with coming off and seeing what's happening.
Yeah.
But definitely, I think one of the things to consider, especially if someone's trying to conceive, is how do we support that follicular development in the first half of the cycle with estrogen supporting herbs? Yeah.
Yeah. And so there are lots of different scenarios here. I think that's why it's quite, it's really helpful to work with a practitioner like yourself that has a lot of experience in this, because there are a lot of different scenarios. Like, well, what if I then don't get a bleed after taking it for 14 days? What next? What do we do? You know, and so having someone like you who then is like, okay, we can either, you know, to either, you know, maybe increase the dose if they've started on a much lower dose, or take it for a longer period of time, or we just need a few more cycles to increase the overall levels to decrease testosterone. You know, there are lots of different scenarios that can work here. There's not a one size fits all approach. It's really working with the biofeedback from the patient to adjust your protocol, right?
Yeah, for sure. Honestly, like every patient is unique in this scenario. It's actually very difficult and complex sometimes to figure it out with patients. But, you know, if the patient is compliant and they're patient and they're willing to give it a try, it definitely can work for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably another thing. I often have patients that are that are trying to conceive, and we're talking about, you know, they've made a lot of lifestyle changes that I've talked to them about in terms of addressing their root cause, but it might not be going fast enough for them. And that's where I say, well, you know, this is a really good option to combine micronized progesterone and lifestyle treatment to maybe bring your, you know, if they, you know, don't have a period at all, or maybe it's you know, still really long cycles and they just want more. Because if you're getting a really long cycle, say 60 days, that's only six times a year that you can try and conceive, right? Like, that's the hard thing. It's not that you can't conceive on a 60-day cycle. It's just that it's just not enough. It's just not enough chances in a year, really. And so it can really extend your time. But then there's also the other, you know, especially those trying to conceive, there's other alternatives like letrozole. From your perspective, what's the benefit, or what's the different, the pros and cons of something like letrozole versus micronized progesterone?
That's a good question. So pros and cons of letrozole versus progesterone, you know,
because we're both doing the same thing, right? We're both trying to achieve the same outcome, which is to get a good corpus luteum, a good follicle that produces a good corpus luteum that produces good amounts of progesterone. Yeah, i.e. getting them to release an egg and then having a sufficient luteal phase to maintain that pregnancy.
Yeah, for sure. You know, what letrozole is doing is it's blocking that conversion from testosterone to estrogen. Showing the body that there's not enough estrogen around. So then FSH gets kicked up. So follicle stimulating hormone stimulates the follicle to release estrogen. So then we eventually then make more estrogens to build that follicle to get things going. Honestly, I think there is benefit to letrozole if the patient hasn't conceived yet using micronized bioidentical progesterone. And because at the end of the day, the patient can use letrozole in the first half of the cycle, they can ovulate, and then they use progesterone in the second half to help, you know, support their levels and potentially, you know, get pregnant that way, because we do have issues sometimes making that estrogen in the first half of the cycle. So if we can kind of, it's basically what letrozole is doing is tricking the brain to make more estrogen. And sometimes patients with PCOS need that because, you know, it's very difficult to get the testosterone down sometimes for some women. unfortunately for some women, it's just testosterone is so stubborn. So it really depends on the person, I think, in terms of like pros and cons of using either or. You know, I always think it's great to start with progesterone, see what happens, and then if things are still stubborn, then maybe even considering letrozole.
Yeah, I agree. I think both are really good. Both can, I mean, both can require some trial and error. So it's not like
100%.
One is necessarily faster. Same, you know, with letrozole, sometimes it can take a few cycles to get the right dose. You know, we want to make sure that
yes.
we're stimulating your body enough to ovulate, but not overstimulating it and putting you into ovarian hyperstimulation.
Right.
So both can require some, I would say on balance, maybe from what I've seen anyway, maybe letrozole might be slightly quicker to get to the end result of a pregnancy. But maybe if it's, maybe the benefit of micronized progesterone is that because we're really supporting your body and doing, you know, we're not kind of tricking it and doing anything. We're just sort of supporting the natural process.
Exactly.
And maybe the, just in terms of that luteal phase and everything else is probably better than just letrozole on its own.
I think so, but like if you're thinking, okay, you know, you're trying to set up your reproductive years and you're figuring, you know, maybe I want to try to conceive in the next 2-3 years, then that's the time to like really start thinking about, okay, I need to get my cycles ready to go. Like maybe progesterone would be a good option in that case, because the more exposure you have by the time you really want to try to conceive, then hopefully your cycles are, you know, in line and regular. But honestly, this whole world is a little bit of trial and error. Like you go to fertility clinics and like, yeah, the fertility reproductive endocrinologists are also doing trial and error. It is very experimental medicine because the hormones are so interesting in PCOS, very, very different among every single PCOS woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other pro I see is probably that letrozole is far more well known than what cyclical micronized progesterone is. So probably in terms of getting it prescribed, especially, I don't know, I just see people in the UK where it's very, very hard to get micronized progesterone prescribed unless you're seeing someone in a private clinic. It's generally not supported to be used. So like on the in the NHS, unless it's for menopause. And so getting it prescribed can be hard. Same thing in New Zealand here. It can be much harder to get it prescribed. You guys in Canada are so, I'm so envious of your amazing naturopathic doctor.
I know, right? We're so lucky.
Yeah, it's so lucky. I wish we had that here. But yeah, it can, it definitely can. I've had patients that have, in every country have had it prescribed, but it just, you know, letrozole is far better known. So if you're, I'd say if you're really, you know, trying to conceive in the next, you know, you're trying at the moment, then maybe something like letrozole might be a quicker option for you. But if you're, as you said, if you're just trying to get your cycles back, maybe it's either gearing up for fertility or actually just trying to ovulate for your, you know, your own health, because there are so many reasons why we want to ovulate that are not related to fertility. Things
exactly,
like
yeah.
our bone health.
Yeah.
Our, you know, our heart health, our breast health, mood, as I said before, like improving PMS symptoms. I have had, I mean, I can't tell you how many personal friends I have that I have recommended to see my doctor here in New Zealand to get micronized progesterone prescribed for PMS, PMDD symptoms. You know, they don't have PCOS, but since they kind of hit 35 or their 30s, they've really noticed a massive escalation in PMS, PMDD symptoms that were really affecting their life, their relationships, their work, and have had great success doing that. So there are a lot of reasons why you might want to just, you know, improve cycles, improve progesterone that are not related to fertility.
Yeah. And endometriosis, I would add to that.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So then, so just on the, we've talked about the, you know, the different reasons why you might want to use cyclical micronized progesterone. So for those that are using it and maybe they've been told, you know, they've read the information from the Center of Ovulation Menstrual Research and it said start on day 14 to take it. What would be the rationale for starting it on cycle day 18 for people that have longer cycles maybe?
So basically just starting it a little bit later just allows that follicle to kind of get to its size, you know, like just giving the body the ability to ovulate on its own. And then we start the progesterone after that. And if at that point the patient hasn't ovulated, like just giving a little bit of that, starting the progesterone a little bit at that time can help get things going. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we find that when we give progesterone a little bit too early, depending on the type of progesterone, it can block ovulation. So for example, an oral form of progesterone, if we give it a little bit too early, it can actually end up blocking ovulation. So we want to just be careful with what we're kind of giving, but also it's okay to not ovulate just yet if the patient has had many years of these irregular cycles at the very beginning of menarche. So when they first ever got their period, their cycles were irregular. Maybe in that circumstance, an oral form of progesterone and every cycle day 14 for a little bit, just to like really get that exposure in, can help with that cycle. But even if the patient's trying to conceive, we don't want to be giving oral form of progesterone. We want to be giving, you know, a suppository, and that won't block ovulation at all because it's not going systemically. It's staying around that in uterine environment. And so we kind of decide based on their history what we should do. Should we start on cycle day 14 if they're having like pretty regular cycles, but maybe they're not conceiving? Maybe we can start a little bit earlier, or do we wait and kind of give them a little bit of time to ovulate on their own and then start the progesterone?
Cool.
Either way, it works.
Yeah. So basically, yeah. So probably a good rule of thumb is that if someone is, you know, ovulating, but they've got a short luteal phase, is maybe either if we know when they're ovulating through various mechanisms, whether that's basal body temperature or ovulation predictor kits or things like that, then try and wait until we've seen that and then give progesterone, but give it in the suppositories, which is vaginally, right? So if you don't know what a suppository is basically inserting it vaginally, which means then that we don't, because it's not going through your mouth and through your bloodstream into your brain, it's not going to block ovulation. It's going to stay local to the ovary and to the your corpus luteum and your endometrium. Whereas if someone is more, I don't know, say let's say they haven't had a period for a year and we're just trying to get them to start ovulating again, that's where it's just, we can definitely use the vaginal suppositories, right? But it's just nicer taking it orally, because the vaginal suppositories, I don't know if you, you've taken it, haven't you, Samantha? Because I remember talking about last time you saw, a massive improvement and just, I know we talked about, you saw body shape changes and you saw like mood and what other things did you notice?
Sleep was much better. So oftentimes because we're making more metabolites that actually increase GABA in our brain, it actually helps us to sleep better, which is really nice, honestly. Nice. If you can't sleep the best. Even like, sleeping well, it just helps to like really get your body into this nice deep sleep. So using oral is definitely indicated if the patient has any issues with sleep or insomnia. And if they've had these like long-term, no periods, maybe they've been on the pill for like many years, like it would be good to kind of start with that oral form of progesterone, just because it is, I would say it is stronger than a suppository. It's just different. It's hard to explain a little bit, you know?
Yeah, that's what I said before about why it's so helpful if you can, working with someone, you know, like yourself, who has had a lot of experience with different patients, because you know how much this varies between from patient to patient. Like, you know, you could have 50 patients all with PCOS, but their treatment protocols could be wildly different. You know, there might be a few similarities, but really it's taking that biofeedback, start one cycle and then get feedback back what happened, might need to change the dose, might change the timing, or where, you know, whether you're providing it orally or vaginally, and then change from there. So to get the best outcome, I think it's really helpful to have someone that's made this before. So that's good. We did touch on there. I mean, I was going to say I've taken both oral and vaginal suppositories. There is a little bit of like, I found sort of just a bit of discomfort in terms of like itchiness, maybe some like like discharge. Some people get like a like an odor, like an odorous discharge as well. So if you know that that's normal, then you can understand that that's that's to be expected, and sometimes it's necessary. But just different reasons why we would take both. But I would say on balance, if it's the right thing for you, then oral is by far the, you know, more pleasant way to take it.
Yeah,
if
for
it
sure.
works for you know, for your situation.
And also if you have heavy cycles, you know, oral could be really nice there. Just because, you know, you don't necessarily want to be putting a suppository in if you're about to, if you're spotting or whatnot. Oral could be a little bit better.
Yeah, right.
But really, even suppositories would be fine too in that case. It's like, it's hard, right? Like, whatever you're experiencing, like, it's almost like trial and error, talking to the patient, seeing what they prefer, and then coming up with a plan, like you said. Yeah.
So the reason that I've used it, I used it in my first trimester of pregnancy because my progesterone was just a little bit low. So even though I have had really regular cycles for probably the last 7 or 8 years, and I've had, so you know, very sufficient luteal phases, so that, you know, talking about from the time I ovulate to when I get my period was at least 11 days or longer, I still found when I was testing my progesterone during the first trimester that it was just a little bit suboptimal. And so I was taking micronized progesterone during that time. So is this common? You know, this is the question that we got here, is the is, I hear some women taking it while pregnant, is that recommended for PCOS?
You know, so first things first, if you're already taking progesterone cyclically while trying to conceive, yes, you should just continue it in that first trimester, right? Because you've, you've been taking it, it's been helping with ovulation. So you should kind of continue that on in the first trimester. It doesn't really make sense to stop it at that point, because why would you? Like, it helped you to ovulate, and it's very safe to take in the first trimester. So I would probably recommend staying on it, depending on, you know, your situation. And then if, for example, you get pregnant and you haven't been taking cyclical progesterone, first things first, like you said, get your progesterone tested, because it's very common for PCOS women to have low progesterone when they get pregnant. And so, and you know, there is this increased risk of miscarriage with women with PCOS. So it's very important to get your progesterone tested, make sure that, you know, levels are sufficient. And if they're not, going on a suppository for at least that first trimester. It's very safe in pregnancy. And, you know, it can, I've seen it, you know, prevent miscarriages. Now, will it stop a miscarriage that's going to happen? Probably not. Like, you'll still probably get a miscarriage if that's what's meant to be for that embryo. Because sometimes, you know, if egg quality or sperm quality isn't the best, like, we can't really do much at that point, right? Because maybe miscarriage is going to happen because the division of that embryo as it's trying to grow may not be the best. And so we might end up with a miscarriage there. But I have had patients ask, like, will the progesterone prevent a miscarriage if a miscarriage is supposed to happen? And it doesn't necessarily do that, but it just helps keep the levels sufficient to help the body sustain the pregnancy.
Yeah. So there's lots of reasons why we can miscarry. One would be, as you said, like a chromosomal abnormality where the sperm or egg quality is not quite right. And that is a protective mechanism, right? We don't want to carry a baby for 9 months and expend all of the energy and all of the emotional energy that goes into that for a baby that's not going to survive outside the womb. So taking progesterone is never going to fix that. But the potential increased risk in PCOS, and the research is still really unclear about this. Some studies show that it's up to maybe, you know, 40% risk of miscarriage as opposed to 10% of the normal population, but others show no increased risk. I think on balance, you and I have probably seen a little bit more increased risk.
A little bit, yeah.
Right? Yeah. So maybe something like maybe halfway in between, maybe something like a 20% increased risk. And much of that could possibly be put down to low progesterone. And just, you know, if we don't have good enough progesterone, I call it our, like our nest. So when we get pregnant, that little, well, when the egg meets the sperm in the fallopian tube, then travels down into our uterus and burrows into the endometrium, which is the bit that, you know, that sheds when we get a period. We want that, I call that the nest. It's like it's there to house that egg and keep it safe. And if we don't have sufficient amounts of progesterone, then that nest won't kind of stay intact. It'll collapse too early before the 12-week mark. And that's why potentially taking the progesterone could help with that.
I like that explanation for sure.
And so this... Yeah, good. This is why I think what I've seen anyway from a lot of IVF clinics prescribe patients progesterone as a standard course of action, right? Like once you've gone through IVF, they're going to prescribe it because they know that there is no increased risk. There's nothing risky about this. And anything that they can do to improve progesterone during that first trimester is only going to help. Well, it's only really going to help improve their live birth rates for the clinic and improve the outcome for the patient.
Exactly, yeah. So this is
we can kind of take a lot of wisdom from, you know, fertility clinics that are doing this all the time, that they're prescribing this. So they're doing that for a reason, and they're doing that for a reason because they've seen that it improves rates. Okay. And so that's why, but it's not necessary for all people with PCOS. I've seen a lot of people that have really good progesterone levels when they do get pregnant. So it is, you know, it is a good idea to get that checked. And then if it is low, then asking for micronized progesterone to be prescribed. On that note, when in the first trimester should people be measuring their progesterone? Because it changes in that first trimester, right?
Yeah, it is hard to know. Just like, honestly, what I say is once you get that positive pregnancy test, go as soon as you can. And then test around that time, and then we can see what's going on. That's probably the best thing to do.
Yeah, that's good. Good advice. So going back to the other questions that we had, the question that we had was around taking cyclical progesterone for people that have no period at all. I think we've answered that, which was that it's one of the, you know, the best uses for cyclical progesterone, right?
Yeah. And basically, maybe I think this question too is asking, like, how do you start the progesterone? And so if you're not getting a period, we're just going to assume the day you get the progesterone in your house, that's the cycle day 18 or cycle day 14. And then we're just going to cycle it every cycle day 14 or every cycle day 18, depending on what we're going to do with it.
So keep starting there. Yeah. And I mean, I have seen such amazing results. I actually just got an email from a patient today who I first saw her in December last year. So it's been 10 months. And she at that point hadn't had a period for probably 2 years. And she's now pregnant, which is great. So, and we've used the micronized progesterone with her to, as well as lifestyle changes, as well as addressing, she had a bit of insulin resistance that wasn't diagnosed. And she, you know, getting her back cycling, and then so that took a couple of months to kind of get the dose right. And then we've sort of been changing that with, so it's not me prescribing, I'm working with her practitioner to kind of work through this. And, so it's taken her, took her a couple of cycles to actually, you know, to actually start ovulating. And then now she's probably had 6 good cycles and has now conceived. So it's a really cool thing. So it's great, especially for someone. And I do see this often, you know, for her that she hadn't had a period for such a long time. She hadn't ovulated naturally for such a long time. I think she thinks possibly has never ovulated in her life because she went on the pill quite young. And then she sort of came off it and hadn't really had any periods since. And so it's likely that her body had never really learned to ovulate. And so by using the micronized progesterone, we can reinstate that probably a lot quicker than what we would not using the micronized progesterone. So really good use case for people that are struggling with just completely missing periods. So what have you seen in terms of side effects? Like someone's asking, can it worsen acne? I know for you, it actually improved acne, but have you seen that it's worsening, has worsened acne, and what do we do about it?
Yeah. So this is a really good question because definitely I think this is a concern when patients are considering any type of hormonal therapy. And I have seen it worsen acne for some women. just a very, very small population of women. I prescribe progesterone a lot. So I've seen, you know, a lot of cases. And from what I can say is it's very uncommon for it to worsen acne, but it is possible for it to worsen acne. And the reason being is sometimes what can happen is the progesterone can actually bind to the estrogen receptor site. So it kind of gets confused. And if it does that, then it can worsen acne. So from what I've seen, this is temporary. So usually once you keep on going with the progesterone, everything kind of levels out. Progesterone knows what to do, like the bioidentical micronized progesterone, and the acne does get better. So yeah, what I would say is yes, there is a certain population of women where it can get worse before it gets better.
I've also seen it in one case where it was first prescribed 100 milligrams, I think it was, by her practitioner, and the acne worsened at 100, but as soon as they bumped her up to 300, it disappeared. And same thing, she got really bad. One of her symptoms previously had been breast tenderness. At 100 milligrams, the breast tenderness got worse. At 300, got much better as well. So sometimes that's a N equals one sample population. Right. But maybe, especially because I do notice with a lot of my, even though the Center for Ovulation Menstrual Research recommends a starting dose of 300 milligrams, a lot of practitioners are scared to start at that dose and they'll start a lot lower. So just because something happens at one dose may not mean that it happens at a different dose. Yeah. The other things I've had would be, I had one that I was talking to today in our PCOS protocol group call. So we have group calls every week. She had been prescribed 50 milligrams initially, and her PMS symptoms got really bad, just insomnia, irritability, way worse. And then as she's on 200 milligrams now, and that's all disappeared. But really interesting to see that different doses can have quite different effects. And I wonder whether that's because, as you said, it's just getting a bit confused binding to the estrogen receptor, but at a higher dose, it's not doing that. So
I usually start with 300 from the recommendations from Jerilyn, Dr. Jerilyn Pryor, and I find that it works really well. Sometimes I'll do 200. It really just depends too. This is what makes like progesterone therapy like so interesting and very complex to treat, right? So which is really interesting, but also really a matter of trial and error again, and like figuring out what's going on with the patient.
Any other side effects you've seen? So we talked about the acne. Anything else that you've seen that can worsen that people should be aware of, or just to know? Because I think the thing is, if you know what to expect and know maybe why it's happening, it can be a lot less scary if it does happen to you.
Yeah. So let's just think about what we're doing here. So we're actually putting in progesterone into the body, right? We're stimulating progesterone receptors. So if you can think about what would happen if you become pregnant, right? We make lots and lots and lots of progesterone. So sometimes symptoms can mimic like symptoms in pregnancy, if you think about it, right? So, breast tenderness, fatigue is a big one, especially on micronized oral progesterone. Nausea, some people do get a little bit of nausea. So just keep that in mind. Bloating. But it's very, I find that a lot of women can tolerate really well, mostly because they need it. Their body needs it. Yeah. So they actually feel much better on it. Some patients will come back and say they were more tired or a little bit more bloating, but they're happy that their cycles are back and they're cycling, they're having periods every month. So I think the benefits outweigh the side effects, but definitely some things to keep in mind.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think on balance, far more people have, much improved symptoms. They're the odd person that might have a negative symptom. But if we think about it as like topping your own body's levels up, then a lot of those symptoms that you're getting, like maybe PMS symptoms, like as you said, insomnia or not being able to sleep, moodiness, irritability, breast tenderness, those things that they've always lived with before their period suddenly are no longer. So, and to avoid the tiredness, make sure you take it at night.
Yes, exactly. Don't take it in the morning.
So final question, Samina, thank you so much for all the information you've given us today. But with the, a lot of people, you know, might get a blood test back and they say, oh my God, my progesterone's at nothing. How do I increase my progesterone naturally? So we go back to that original thing we talked about before, that often, you know, if you're getting a progesterone test done and you're not ovulating, you haven't had a period, then it is going to be low, right? Because we're, you're not ovulating, you're not producing progesterone. So way to get it back naturally is to start ovulating.
Exactly. So
easier said than done, right?
100%. 100%, because it's so different between each person. So we really want to work on that follicular phase, right? Building good amount of estrogen, bringing the testosterone down. Where is that testosterone coming from? Is it coming from the adrenal glands where we produce DHEAS? Is it coming from the ovaries? Is testosterone high because there's insulin resistance present? Why is the testosterone high? So then improving that testosterone will help increase the estrogen. Sometimes we may need to use herbs here just to like bring that estrogen up. So maybe we're using black cohosh. Maybe we're using wild yam, just in that botanical form, not in the progesterone form. And then a lot of people think Vitex in this case, because Vitex has been studied for increasing progesterone. But remember, Vitex only helps the corpus luteum. So it's not actually helping the follicular phase, really. It's helping that corpus luteum make progesterone. So Vitex is really only helpful if a patient, in my opinion, and maybe, you know, other people have other experiences with it. But I've really only seen it work if the patient is ovulating, but their progesterone in the second half of the cycle is low. So maybe Vitex is a good option in this case.
And I've seen, and this is something, Vitex is a little bit finicky. Some, on the whole, it's not one that I really find most people with PCOS, because one of the things it can do is it can increase that luteinizing hormone, that one that helps us ovulate, and which is already in many people with PCOS a bit high. And it's not, definitely not the case for all people. It's just, and it's mentioned in some research and not in others, but I don't know. I've personally seen it a couple of times in a couple of people, and makes me just a little bit wary about using, you know, especially people listening to this podcast and going and buying, you know, a bottle of Vitex off iHerb. And it's like, if you don't know, you know, as you said, what actually is causing the problem, then actually herbs are kind of like medication, right? We need to use them in the right context. Otherwise they may have a negative effect, and especially something as finicky as Vitex. So can be helpful, but probably not one to, you know, to do on your own. Same with black cohosh, right? It can be a little bit finicky to get the right dose, and maybe not one to use by yourself.
Honestly, no herbs should be used by yourself. It's you're right. They are very strong, and they do actually change hormones. And sometimes you'll end up taking something and then you won't realize what it's actually done to your cycles because you're just used to taking it. But definitely, I would say anytime you're ever taking anything, especially botanical medicine, you need somebody like a herbalist, a naturopathic doctor, somebody that can actually help guide you, because they can really impact hormones.
So if you're wanting to, the other thing that we can get, you know, when people say to me, oh, my progesterone's low, sometimes as well, so it's A, either you're not ovulating, or B, as well, that test has been taken at the wrong time of your cycle. Is often if progesterone's really low, they say, oh, my progesterone's, you know, 0.1, and I'm like, okay, well, it's probably that they've taken it before you've ovulated. So that can be another thing. So, but really it's about if, you know, we, in terms of improving progesterone naturally, that's about improving cycles. So improving ovulation, as you said, improving that follicular phase. We get a good follicle, a good quality egg, which then produces a good quality corpus luteum. And that can take, it can take many, many months to achieve that, if not years, in many people, as you said. And some people will just have really stubborn testosterone that does not come down with any amount of lifestyle change. Or maybe not, it comes down a bit, but maybe not enough to achieve the goal that you want. And so sometimes using a combination of the both can be really helpful or get you to the outcome quicker.
That's right. Yeah, I agree with that for sure.
Cool. Anything else you wanted to, I know that you got, you know, some questions and we got some, I got some questions. Anything else that you wanted to cover off before we, that I haven't asked you?
You know, one question that came up that maybe I think a lot of people would have is, how do you support progesterone production with diet? And I do think it's possible to help progesterone levels with diet, but I don't know if it would actually, you know, kickstart ovulation with the things that I'm just going to talk about. So this is more so you've already ovulated and now we're helping your progesterone. We're helping the progesterone levels in the body. So if we're talking about how to like help that follicular phase, it's a little bit different. We're working on bringing the testosterone down, working on insulin resistance, right? So balancing blood sugar, bringing, you know, sugar out of the diet, things like that. So that's a whole other podcast, which I'm sure you've probably already done. But even if we're just trying to help support progesterone production in that luteal phase, things like omega-3 fatty acids, like from fish, good quality fish and flax seeds, and then foods that are rich in vitamin B6, like sunflower seeds, fish, turkey, even foods that are rich in zinc, so pumpkin seeds, seafood, maybe beef or even nuts. And then vitamin C also, you know, things like broccoli, peppers, spinach, tomatoes, strawberries. Mm-hmm. These are all really basically a diet rich in healthy foods. If you think about it, right? Yeah.
So focus on good quality fatty fish with lots of vegetables. Some, if you eat, you know, if you do eat meat, some red meat to help with like zinc. But if you're pescatarian, then you can just stick with the fatty fish and your slow carbohydrates. So things like, you know, so we're still balancing blood sugar. So trying to stay away from those refined sugars and anything refined white. So
exactly
like your white breads and your white pastas and stuff like that. That's been literally anything that's where you've taken the whole form and pummeled the shit out of it and then reconstituted it to make something else. It's not going to be great for blood sugar.
No, for sure.
Yeah. Or if you want an even more simple rule, it's just going eat things as close to what they found in nature as opposed to things that have been manufactured, and you'll probably go okay when it comes to that.
Yeah.
So, but if you want further guidance on that, then otherwise, you know, if you're local to Semenya, then go and see her in clinic. Or if you're not, then working with us in the PCOS protocol, we can help guide you through all of these different things and all of these different steps. So brilliant. Well, thank you so much for that. That has been amazing and such a valuable resource to all of our people with PCOS out there who are wanting to know more about how they could potentially use cyclical progesterone therapy, but may not have a practitioner that knows what to do. So sometimes it's really, really, you know, you might be one of their first patients with us and you can help guide them, but maybe pointing them to this podcast or pointing them to the resources from the Center of Ovulation and Menstrual Research. And the more practitioners that know about this, the more people with PCOS that know about this to ask their practitioners for, I think the more research we're going to get, the more case studies we're going to get, and it's going to become a very common treatment for PCOS.
Yeah, for sure. That's the ultimate goal, I think.
Absolutely. So thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
So that's all for today. Remember that if you want personal help with your PCOS, then the best place for that is our PCOS protocol program. This is not some generic PDF that you get sent. This is the first week we understand, identify what's driving your PCOS, and then you get given the most important changes for you. So, and I'm there with you the whole way, answering questions, being there with you weekly on the video calls, further personalizing this for you and identifying if there's anything else that might be going on for you. I mean, every week we talk with different women about different symptoms and you know, that might lead them to get an endometriosis diagnosis or find out that they've got small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And that's what you can understand from hearing these stories from women is about that often there's connecting issues that when we actually look at them holistically, we figure out what's actually happening for them. So if you want more information about that, then there is a link in the show notes, or you can head to thepcosnutritionist.com /thePCOS protocol, or just hit program from the main menu. And if you've got any questions, then please don't hesitate to email us. We're hello@thePCOSnutritionist.com. Bye for now.
Now stand by for our disclaimer. The information contained in this podcast has been prepared for the purpose of providing information, including about the PCOS Nutritionist products and services, and is designed to support clients' overall wellness. It is not intended to provide medical advice or designed to rectify, treat, or cure any specific medical conditions or diseases. Nothing stated or shared in our podcast is intended to be and must not be taken to be medical advice. Please seek the advice of professionals as appropriate regarding the evaluation of any specific information, opinion, advice, or content contained in our podcast.